Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 285 on Friday, January 17th, 2014. Greetings from downtown Denver, Colorado, where tomorrow my two hometowns will square off for the AFC Championship and a chance to play in the Super Bowl. I confess to knowing very little about professional sports. I don't usually have time to follow it, but when the stakes get this high, I do enjoy tuning in for the excitement. Denver has been awash with over-the-top orange clothing this week, and if the Broncos win Sunday, the streets downtown here are going to be filled with enthusiastic celebrants. In fact, I think there's a pretty good chance there'll be extra security down in the lobby of our building here. Darlene and I can see Sports Authority Field at Mile High from our kitchen and dining room windows, but that's not going to be true by this time next year for the playoffs. That's because we have a front row seat on a huge construction project going up across the street, and when it's completed, our view of the stadium and the Rockies will be just a pleasant memory. There still will be a pretty good view of the mountains out the living room window, but when you live in an urban high-rise in a growing city, you certainly can't assume that your view is never going to change. When I'm in Denver, I root for the Rockies, but if the visiting Patriots win, I'm going to be glad to know how much joy that's going to bring to all my family back in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Either way, it should be a pretty good game. I am not sure which team my guest this week will be supporting, but he is certainly a longtime supporter of the Clearwater High School Tornadoes in Clearwater, Florida. Keith Masteritis is the pioneering principal who 3 years ago figured out a way to buy 2,100 Kindle keyboards, one for every student in his school. I caught up with him this week to find out how the program has evolved since then and what he sees ahead.
I think eventually what you'll see is a school will buy X number of devices for those that don't have or can't afford, and then kids will be bringing their own devices, so it'll be a blend. I really see that happening.
In news, I will ponder a mysterious report of something bigger than the Kindle afoot back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a new Pew study of the reading habits of American adults, and a report from the recently concluded Digital Book World Conference in New York. For the tech tip, I'm going to share my experience connecting a Kindle Fire HDX to a supposedly smart TV, and I will point you to an improvement being rolled out for the Manage Your Kindle page at Amazon.com. And as always, I'll have a few suggestions for things that you can read or play with on your Kindle devices. First up in news is a report that I wish had broken when we were back in Boston. Scott Kersner, a columnist at the Boston Globe, got a hold of an invitation to an event hosted by something called Amazon's Kindle New Initiatives, K&I team, on Thursday, December 30th from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Kersner on January 13th reported that the free food and drinks event was held in Kendall Square, which is where MIT is, just two subway stops away from Harvard. Cambridge is also where Amazon has hired at least 80 people for a research and development office that was back in 2012, which Kersner reported on a year ago. The recent invitation said it would be, quote, an opportunity to meet Amazon's creative leaders and engineers who are responsible for the next generation of consumer products. And the pitch concluded with this tantalizing wording. Quote, we are working on a new revolutionary V1, that's version 1, product that will allow us to deliver digital media to our customers in new ways and disrupt the current marketplace. We have teams in various locations partnering on this project from Sunnyvale, Lab 126, Seattle, to right here in Boston. We believe this new product will be even bigger than the Kindle! Exclamation mark. And then the invitation had a link to Lab 126 for questions. This, of course, has sparked lots of speculation and revived earlier rumors of a Kindle TV or a Kindle phone. I don't think Amazon generally makes idle claims about new initiatives, so when they characterize a project that they're working on as revolutionary V1, I think you know something pretty big is up. So this is probably something we can't even imagine at this point. I feel like Charlie Rose when they led him nearly blindfold into the room that had the Prime Air drone showcased on the 60 Minutes episode, and the reaction when all this is finally revealed will probably be something like his his stunned mumbling and exclamations, which were cut. I think there was a sort of a separate outtake for that 60 Minutes show, which showed him going into the room. It was pretty funny. So I don't know that much about television technology, to tell you the truth, and I'll make that evident in the tech tip. So I'm not overly excited about some fancy new media device that's linked to TV. I'd like to see a killer new ebook subscription program, but I don't think that's going to happen as long as the major publishers can continue to sit on their hands whenever Amazon comes up with an initiative that would benefit from the publisher's participation. So we'll see. I have an email out to James McQuivey, who I like to call the Duke of Disruption, for his savvy analysis of digital media for Forrester Research, to see what he might have heard about what's happening in his neighborhood, since he lives and works just west of Boston. Listener David Enzel passed along his take on the story, writing yesterday, quote, "I have a feeling this is big. I have no inside information, but there has been no Amazon phone, and I doubt now that there will be a phone, but Bezos is up to something. My sense is that Apple is getting left behind, and Google and Amazon are major competitors because they both provide services through the cloud. Apple sells hardware, and in my mind, hardware is becoming less important. I think of my Fires and Paperwhite as ways to access Amazon content. The devices come and go, but the content is what I am really buying." I think David may be right about the phone, but I think actually there is going to be one coming by the spring. So I would bet that that's not a dead project at this point. He's definitely right, in my opinion, about the real product being the content that we get on the various devices. I'm going to try to do some sleuthing on this story, and in fact, I'm going to be back in Cambridge next week for a one-day workshop that Chris Brogan is giving in Boston that also give me a chance to check in on my father and my family. As this is going to recording here, I've actually had a pretty fascinating development, which makes me think I might get a lot closer to this story next week when I'm out there. Actually, it'd be the following week when I'm just before I fly back to Denver on January 30th, than I thought I would. I was doing some sleuthing just here online, and I found a way that seemed to put me in a position where I might find out something about this story that would be pretty fun to pass along. But I'm going to keep it under my hat until I really have something to talk about, and there's a pretty good chance that this exciting lead that has got my old reporter's instincts on high alert might not pan out at all. If you are someone in Cambridge who is involved in this project and you'd like to share your enthusiasm with a very discreet former journalist who would protect your confidentiality to the death, you could send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. And for the rest of you, if you've got ideas about what might be afoot here, I'd love to hear about that too. And it's just so neat that something like this could be happening out in Cambridge, where we spend half the year. And I think the overall thing which is exciting is the sense that Lab 126 has been the main source of technology for the Kindle platform. That's where the original Kindle was developed and all the subsequent ones, right there in Cupertino. And the idea that there would be an eastern outpost of Lab 126, naturally enough, settled right in Cambridge, apparently closer to MIT than to Harvard. And, of course, MIT has that world-famous media lab where so many innovations get their start, including e-ink, which was, of course, the foundation for the original Kindle. So this is pretty exciting stuff. Next in news, Pew Internet is out with solid data on how American adults are reading these days. What surprises me about the survey, which was done in January after the holiday season, is that it shows slower growth than I would have expected in the percentage of adults in the U.S. reading e-books, at the same time that the saturation of tablets and e-readers continues to grow at a solid clip. And it also shows that print is still holding on, that most people are reading books in print, and the idea that I think some of us might have had 4 or 5 years ago, when this thing got started with such excitement, that the day of the end of print books was coming anytime soon. That just doesn't seem to be borne out by the data. Andrew Albanese at Publishers Weekly yesterday, January 16th, posted a crisp, clear overview of the report titled Pew, E-Reading Surges, But Print is Hanging On. Here's some tidbits from Andrew's report. The one that was the most shocking to me is that there are only 4% of readers that they surveyed in this report from Pew. Only 4% are e-book only. And that surprises me, because whenever I talk to people, you know, here listening to the podcast and sort of in my circle, which is maybe just very exclusively Kindle-centric, unusually so, I generally find people like Darlene and other people saying that once they get reading this way, they switch to reading ebooks only. But here the data says that there's only 4% of readers, adult readers in the U.S., are ebook only. You know, the rest are reading a mix of things. Overall, 76% of adults read a book in some format over the previous 12 months. That means one out of four people just didn't read a book, no matter ebook, paper, or anything. The growth in the devices that was apparent, it showed that 42% of adults now own tablet computers, and that's up from 34% just in September of last year. So that's sort of the result of the holiday season buying spree. That's tablet computers. And the number of adults who own dedicated e-readers also rose pretty smartly from 24% in September up to 32% in January. Fully half of all Americans, 50%, now own either a tablet or an e-reader, and that's up from 43% in September. Yeah, so I'll have a link to that story. You can, there's some other data, and I also have a link to the actual report from Pew. It shows pretty steady progress or growth in the ebook reading, slower than I would have expected at this point, but still pretty much marching on. And it doesn't appear there's just, I don't think there's any turning back that's evident in these numbers. The last news story I want to talk about is a report that I heard out of Digital Book World. That's a great conference that was held, concluded this week in New York City. I attended it last year, but was unable to do so this year. And the report that I heard was on a podcast done by Publishers Weekly. It's the PW Radio, which is a great podcast. I'd recommend listening to it because there's lots of information about books and ebooks, and Publishers Weekly is a terrific publication. This the report, they had Calvin Reed, who is a senior editor at PW, talking about his impressions of the Digital Book World. And the part that I thought you'd be interested in was where he talks about how Amazon was perceived at the conference, and this is what he had to say.
Amazon was a kind of a shadow topic at this year's DBW, as it is almost in almost every publishing gathering.
Sure.
But really on Wednesday morning, they just pulled out all the stops, and it was all Amazon all the time for the morning session. Mm-hmm. And all pretense aside, this is what people wanted to talk about, both looking at Amazon's past and its impact on the book industry and where the industry was going with Amazon in the future. So there was, in my opinion, a kind of refreshing sense that enough with the complaining about Amazon. Enough with the complaining about the Department of Justice mm-hmm. in the Apple ebook price fixing trial. It's time for publishers to compete, to innovate, and that's the best way to deal with, you know, the market share monster that is Amazon.com. So Brad Stone, the author of The Everything Store, mm-hmm. the popular bestseller that's been out here, he was on hand, as well as Joe Esposito, a management consultant, really kind of talking about what's been happening with Amazon, where it's going, and what publishers can do, because Amazon's not changing its business model.
Right.
They're relentless.
It's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. They're going to continue to pursue market share in any way they possibly can. They're going to, what they did in the book publishing industry, we know they're doing it in other areas, but that doesn't mean that they're going to turn their gaze away from the book industry. They will continue doing it as they always have. And publishers need to come up with business strategies that are both legal and can make a dent.
I was glad to hear that. And one thing I noticed in just watching the news coming about the Digital Book World Conference as it was being promoted was that they were going to have a whole morning talking about Amazon, and there was nobody from the company that was going to be in the program. They had Brad Stone, as was mentioned, and he got a chance to talk about the thesis about Amazon in his book, The Everything Store, a really well-done book, and also a consultant that knows a thing or two about Amazon. But I thought it odd that there wasn't anybody there, so I reached out to Jeremy Greenfield, who basically organizes and is the director for the show, to ask if Amazon had been invited to participate, and if they had declined, what did they say about it, and just to get a little background. I pretty quickly received a reply from Mike Schatzkin, who is also intimately involved in the creation of this show, and he wrote as follows. Len, since I'm the guy who books everything at DBW, Jeremy Greenfield passed your question about Amazon to me. I always invite Amazon to speak on our programs. Sometimes they say yes and sometimes they don't. I think it is mostly based on whether they have a message they want to get across to the particular audience at the particular time. Most recently, Russ Grandinetti did a great talk at our Publishers Launch Frankfurt conference last October. This year, Russ noticed our Amazon programming and invited me to have our speakers check in with him if they wanted any factual information. I believe both Stone and Esposito, that was the other speaker on that panel, availed themselves of the opportunity Russ offered. In the same context, you might want to know that both Apple and Barnes & Noble were also invited to speak and declined. Thanks for your interest, Mike. So I really appreciated hearing right from Mike Schatzkin himself about that background. And I think that he in particular is extremely savvy about the publishing business. He grew up in it. His father was in publishing. And he has been a proponent of digital publishing for a long time. And yet he covers and is intimately related to these big publishers. A lot of his ventures have to do with publishers sending people to the events. So to the extent that there's fear and loathing about Amazon in among clients of his that are important to him, he perhaps has to tread a bit of a thin line. But I think he does it well. And I'm glad to hear from Calvin Reed's report that the dealing with Amazon seems to be taking place in a calmer mode this year. I would say that was pretty much the sentiment last year as well, but it sounds like things are progressing even further as we get further away from the Department of Justice lawsuit and people just settle down to reality. And as Jeff Bezos has famously said recently, whining is not a strategy, and I think a lot of people in these circles are realizing that, and that lays the groundwork for a lot of innovation and things which are going to benefit us as readers. A couple of items and tech tips. The first is I've seen tantalizing hints that there's a major redesign afoot for the Manage Your Kindle page. That's you can get there by going to amazon.com/myk for Manage Your Kindle. This is where all of your archive shows up, and you can search for books that are in your archive, and you can move books to different devices. And the big change that has been discussed, I haven't seen it yet on my account. I think it may be being rolled out gradually. The big change is that you can batch process things, and that to me would be a huge improvement in the usability of the Manage Your Kindle. In other words, if I wanted several books that I wanted to delete, and after all this time using personal documents to move things onto my Kindle to read, I have a lot of things in my archive that I really should go through and prune once in a while, but under the current system, you have to do it one item at a time, and it's really tedious. There also might be a way to move several items to one of your Kindle apps or devices at a time with this setup. Now, Tom Semple, I think, had seen this on the Kindle for Android app on one of his devices. When I tried it on my Nexus 7, I didn't see it. So at this point, I just haven't seen this new interface rolled out. But you might want to check it and see if you're one of the accounts that has been upgraded so far. I put an inquiry into Amazon Public Relations to find out if they could tell me anything official about it, but I haven't heard back. But pretty sure something's afoot there, and that it's going to be a benefit. And if you see it on your account, I'd appreciate it if you'd send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. Maybe include a screenshot or something so I can see what it looks like if you see it before I do. The next thing I'm going to talk about on Tech Tip, I don't usually talk about television, but we decided to get a smart TV for the guest room. This is Darlene and I don't know whose idea this was, but for some reason we ended up ordering a nice 32-inch flat-screen TV for the guest room, and then she used the old one to play quilting DVDs in her quilting studio, and we had some guys in here, and they set it up, and the whole thing was great. A lot of what was motivating me in spending this money and doing this project was I just wanted to try the second screen feature on the Kindle Fire HDX. And from the advertisements and just reading about it, I thought it was going to be a pretty simple thing. You buy a smart TV, and then you go to the settings on your Kindle Fire HDX, and then you can watch Alpha House or any other content that you have on the Kindle HDX on your big screen. Well, it didn't turn out to be that simple at all. And I got help from Amazon. I got help from the TV tech support. Actually, I didn't get very good help from them at all. They didn't seem to have ever even heard of a Kindle Fire. But the biggest help I got was from Netgear. And there is a device called Push to TV. It costs about $58 on Amazon. And it turned out that I had to buy one of these and plug it into the HDMI port on the Samsung television. And then there was also a cable that I could get power to this little device. It's only about 3 inches long, a very small little box that hangs beneath the TV. And once it was set up, it translates the signal from the Kindle Fire HDX to the TV and I could watch it. Well, it was a nightmare because the Netgear was, they sent me a beta test of the software for the device and I had to agree to a non-disclosure agreement because I was getting beta software. This went on for 3 or 4 hours before this thing finally started working and I was able to see it. Now, once I did see it, it was disappointing because when I was streaming TV from the Kindle Fire HDX, it was pixelated, the audio was really choppy, and it just was really miserable to watch. I would have never really watched it that way. When I chose to look at something that I had downloaded to the Kindle Fire, that flowed pretty easily, and the Netgear guy was saying, you know, maybe the problem is you're using the internet to get the TV onto your HDX and you're using the internet, your Wi-Fi at your house to send it to the television. Maybe that's just too much processing for it to handle. We've got really fast internet here in the house. So today I tried Mayday to see if I could get an answer on this, and the tech support said try restarting the Kindle Fire HDX. And when I did that, the quality was pretty good when I was streaming. I think it was Alpha House or something that was coming across from Prime Instant Video. After all this, I called Amazon and I said, is there a TV I can buy at Amazon that will enable me to stream, use this second screen feature of the HDX without buying this Netgear box for an additional $58? And the guy looked around and he basically said, it doesn't look like it. So if you are going to take advantage of this, and if you fell for the apparent simplicity of this based on the ads when the HDX first came out, I'm here to warn you that it's more complicated than it looks, especially for somebody who has as little TV expertise as I do. I think it's going to be fun to have it, and I'm glad I went through the exercise, and it is now working. And that's my story about installing the second screen capability from my HDX. Time now for the interview. Keith Mastoritis has served 8 years as principal at the school from which he himself graduated, 3 years ago, I learned of his project to provide Kindles to all 2,100 students at that school, which is Clearwater High School in Clearwater, Florida, and that's on the Gulf Coast of Florida, about 20 miles west of Tampa. At that time, he was working with a guy named John Just, Assistant Superintendent for Management Information Systems for the huge Pinellas County School District, which includes Clearwater. When I tried to track John Just down this week for a follow-up interview, I learned that he had moved on to another job, so I found myself talking with the principal whom John had described in such glowing terms as the prime mover of this first-in-the-nation a Kindle for Every Student project. I reached Keith Mastoritis on Tuesday, January 14th, with a Skype-to-phone connection, and I began by asking him about his long history with Clearwater High School, home of the Tornadoes.
I graduated from here in 1987, and it's pretty neat to be be the principal of the school you graduated from and go back in your community and give back. It's kind of neat. Clearwater High School has about 22 to 25% of its staff as alumni, so people really want to come back and make a difference in the community.
Were you a problem for the principal in your day?
No, I was a quiet guy, but I knew him. That's pretty neat. He still comes to events, graduation and that kind of stuff. So it's neat to see him and talk a little bit. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's neat.
Pretty cool.
Well,
yeah.
Tell me how the Kindle project got started. I think it was back in 2010.
Yes. I went to John Just, who at that time was coordinator of technology for the entire district. We've got a pretty large district here, 16 high schools, 50-plus middle schools, real large. And I went to him and said, look, I'd really like to look at my budgets. At that time, we had a program called Decentralized Decision Making, where principals could look at their programs and budgets and tweak them as they feel necessary if they put in a strong business plan. So I went to John and said, I'd really like to look at our technology dollars and find a way maybe we can use those dollars over a period of time to buy a device and do a one-to-one project, because we really hadn't had one in our district at that time with all of our students. And John indicated to me at that point that it was too expensive to do a computer, because that was my first thought. He said, but let's look at other devices. Let's look at what's out there. Look at what you really want to do. At that point, we said we wanted to find a way to get onto the Internet to do research, kids be able to look on, because we have a portal system where kids can go on and look at their grades and attendance, and parents can do that as well. So we wanted a system that would allow the kids to be able to do that. We wanted them to be able to read digital text and what was out there. So we started looking, and we ran into the Kindles. We thought e-readers. Let's look at the e-readers. When we looked at all of the e-readers at that time, the Kindle had more options and bells and whistles and opportunity for us to grow than any other device. At that time, it had the largest inventory, and I think they still do, Amazon does, largest inventory of materials. They really wanted to work with us. It was the least expensive of the ones, so we thought, let's go with this. So we went with what they call the Kindle keyboard today, which is their white with the black image device.
Mm-hmm.
It has limited internet. It's got 3G on it, basically, so the kids could go on, and you think about my kids that they don't have the resources at home. All of a sudden, we've given everybody a fair playing ground. They could do homework and research. They can look up their grades and attendance. They could, like I said, we've got books, novels, be able to get on the Internet to do read the St. Pete Times and the Tampa Tribune. So we thought, gosh, this would be a great device to use. And that's why we grabbed it and started doing it.
Now, are you still using those same devices, or has the program shifted to a different platform?
We still use those devices, but the program has shifted a bit, and let me tell you what's happened. There's several pieces that we've built along the way. As you know, technology it's constantly changing, and every 3 years you've got to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. Since then, as you know, color's become a key thing. The price has gone down on many of the devices, and video, those kind of things that we couldn't do initially, have all become key factors in devices today. Now, the main reason why we did this, too, let's back up and talk about that. We know that the kids today, that's where they live. They live on technology. And we want to find ways to tap into their love of technology and get them using it in the classrooms more. So let's fast forward a little bit. Since we've started the program, we've seen some great success. We've got our math books on there, our science books, and our English books. They're all available. We've got about 150 novels that we can access. Still have the St. Pete Times and Tampa Tribune access. And we also have, like I said, the portal access so the kids can look at grades, attendance, schedules, all that kind of stuff. Since then, we've gone ahead and we found some additional funds to purchase more labs. We bought some color labs, about 45 of them, that we've placed in the classrooms. So the kids have...
Color tablets?
Yep, color Kindles.
Oh, okay.
We use the high-def
fire
ones.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, so those are in the classrooms. We've got 45 sets of those, so the teachers can share them. So now we've also got the color introduced. That was the next step that we did. We've also gone to what we call Bring Your Own Technology, and we started this last year, where students are allowed to bring their own devices and use them. So as long as they can access an Amazon account, which we've created, they're able to get all the materials on their own device.
Mm-hmm.
So now not only do we have the devices in the classroom, the Kindle Fires, we've got the Kindle keyboards for those that don't have a device, and for the kids that want to bring their own devices, they can do that. So we've really stepped it up and moved it up to the 21st century. And it's gone very well. I mean, it's a blended approach. Instead of, for years, as educators, we've said, you can't bring those devices on campus. They need to be off and away during the school day. We're embracing it. We're saying we want you to use them appropriately. We want to teach our kids how to use them in the right context. You know, there's ways you shouldn't use those devices and should use them, and that's what we're trying to teach the kids what to do.
That becomes part of the education that you're offering them.
Exactly. You know, when the child walks into the classroom, it's the teacher's environment. And if they say, today we're not using electronic devices, you need to put them off and away, that's what the kids are required to do. If a child's in the hall in the passing time and they need to make a quick phone call to their parent or text them, we don't have a problem with that. I mean, we want them to be able to communicate with their parents, and we think it's a good thing, and it's been great. Really, really good.
When you distributed all of those 2,100 Kindles to mm-hmm. every student at the school back in 2010, you really were a pioneer. I think you were the first school in
yes.
the nation to do that.
Yes.
And it's obvious you've kept pace since then. Are you seeing any metrics that let you know this has improved graduation rates or mm-hmm. increased enrollment mm-hmm. or reading rates? How can you tell whether this has been successful?
We've seen a great increase in what we call our lowest 25. Our students that have difficulty with reading and math, we've seen a great increase in them.
That's the lowest 25%?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen, when we look at our scores, we've seen some increases. We've seen a small increase in graduation rate. But again, that takes time. One of the biggest pieces is this year, first time in our history, we received an A designation from the state of Florida.
Great.
Yes. Wow. So we've seen some success.
Yeah, and you attribute that to, there's lots of other things that are
right.
going into those, but the technology is a part of it.
I'd say it was one factor, absolutely.
Looking back at 2010, I understand you were also looking at iPads at that time. Do you ever regret not jumping right into that technology as opposed to the e-ink Kindle?
We weren't looking at the iPads because they were too expensive.
Oh, okay.
It would cost us $2.50. For every one Kindle, it would cost you $2.50
yeah.
to buy one iPad. So we weren't looking at those. We were looking at iPods at that point, but our concern was the screen, the size of the screen.
Right.
But what we've learned, now that we're allowing kids to bring their own devices, that's not an issue for them. They're used to using those smaller screens for this kind of stuff. So for them, it's not a big deal. I think for the adults, it was more of a big deal than it is for them. So maybe, possibly, if I knew that going in, maybe we would have used the iPods, because you could still get the Amazon accounts there.
Mm-hmm.
You could still do that. There's more apps at that point. So maybe, I don't know, there's still a concern. When you think of an iPod, you think of it more as a toy.
Yeah, music.
Than you do an educational tool.
Mm-hmm.
So that would probably be the only concern there. But we did look at those.
Yeah. Well, now, you've worked pretty closely with Amazon through this whole project. What do you think mm-hmm. they've learned about the textbook business from their experience at Clearwater?
You know, that's been our biggest hurdle, and they're the provider of the equipment. So we had to, with their help, work with all these textbook companies to get them to agree to give us digital content. And it was meeting with each one individually. It was a lot of work to do that. You know, it wasn't an easy thing. It wasn't just, here's the book, have at it. It was, we need to get it. We need to get it transferred so it's work, you know, all the utilities and devices on the Kindle will work on it. So there was quite a bit of work involved in getting those available for the kids.
Is it going easier now, working with the publishers?
Yes, it, a little bit. But the biggest thing is the whole WhisperNet.
Yeah.
They've had to create that, and that really came out of working with us. There really was no process for pushing content. I mean, we really had to go in and give them spreadsheets of our students, the devices, and the materials needed on each one. And then we had to, after that, go through and make sure they were done right. Amazon had to go through, send them back through. So it was a lot of work.
So that's really how they created this WhisperCast ability to manage a site like yours. It ought to be called the Clearwater WhisperCast system, it sounds like.
That's neat. Yeah, you're probably right. They really designed it for us to use first. And there's a couple schools throughout the nation that have gone this way. You really have to ask them who else is doing it at this point.
How about in Pinellas County? Do you have any of the other high schools have followed you on this trail?
Not at this point, because you know they've really seen us move real quickly into the whole bring your own technology, and they're really leaning towards that more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
I think eventually what you'll see is a school will buy X number of devices for those that don't have or can't afford, and then kids will be bringing their own devices, so it'll be a blend. I really see that happening. Kind of like what we do now when you think about the pencil or the pen, paper, and where folks are bringing their own materials. If you go back 100 years and you know when they were talking about moving from pen and ink to the pen, how everybody went into shock mode that this was going to destroy the world of education, that we've got to teach the kids how to use pen and ink. And you think about that paradigm shift, I think that's where we're at today.
I can imagine sort of a disparity if a more well-to-do student can bring in the latest Kindle Fire HD 8.9-inch and someone from a more modest background would be depending on the Kindle keyboard. Does that create sort of a two-class system because of the differences in the technology and what people can use?
We haven't seen that yet. Most of our kids actually do have some type of device with so we really haven't seen that issue. And I also think, plus let's back up a second. We also have in the classroom those Kindle Fires
right,
that we're using. So I haven't seen that as an issue yet, to be quite frank.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, and I think, moving forward when schools purchase their equipment, and it's gone, the prices have gone down so much that you could afford to buy 300, say, for a school of 2,000 Kindle Fires or HDs. So that they could, work with the students that don't have. I think you could make it work.
Well, I remember John just 3 years ago told me that you were a particularly good principal to take the lead on a project like this because you combined vision and willingness to innovate with what he called intestinal fortitude. He was very high on you. I remember his description of you made me curious about who is this principal that is making this all happen. But did you have points, particularly in the early times, when the obstacles just seemed so high that you were tempted to back off and not be a pioneer?
No.
Why not?
Well, we knew that the challenges were going to be there, and we were just up for them. To be honest with you, we knew I'm not one of these guys that the class is half empty. It's half full, and we've got to find ways to fill it. And the bottom line is we just said that it's going to happen. Let's keep working, and that's what we did. And I'm really glad that we did it. And the other piece is, too, I'm one of these folks that, I understand the whole concept of a paradigm shift, and what you think the shift is going to be might not be exactly what it is when you finish. And I think using the bring-your-own technology and bringing more devices in the classroom was a key to continuing that project in a different flavor and form as we move forward.
So what advice would you have for other principals or school administrators in dealing with technology based on what you've learned in the last 3 years?
Keep your options open. That's for sure. And don't be afraid to try something.
And what's next for Clearwater High? What do you see coming down in the next 1 to 3 years?
Well, we've done quite a bit in the last 3 years or so. We've instituted a modified student uniform dress code. We've changed our expectations with the kids coming in. We want more of a professional atmosphere here on campus, and that's been a positive force. We've also moved to a wall-to-wall certification model where students coming in, academy model, wall-to-wall academy model with certifications, where students come to our school and they select academy and area of interest, and during their time here they have certification options so that when they graduate high school they leave with more than a high school diploma. For example, we've got a business program and they can get Microsoft certified there. So every one of our students coming in, they have an area of interest and they can select one of those to move forward in their career here. It's for their education. It's all about getting them excited about education and wanting to do something interesting, you know, something that interests them. So it's taking those electives and making them the focal point. And then all of our courses are working with them. So when you're in English class, they're talking about business language and that kind of thing. So it's at flavor, if that makes sense. Hmm. We're starting next year with Emory Riddle, a new academy, an aerospace academy. It'll be the first one in our district where students will be able to get a ground pilot's license or certifications in engineering. So we're doing some very cutting-edge stuff.
I have been speaking with Keith Mastoritis, principal at Clearwater High School in Clearwater, Florida. Thanks very much, Keith.
Thank you. You have a great day.
In content, I want to talk about the Kindle First picks for January. They came out early, at the start of the month. They are a thriller, The Barkeep by William Lashner, Nancy Nagel's Mint Juleps and Justice, an Adams Grove novel that's a romance. There's a horror title, Descending Sun by Scott Shepard, and there's one labeled Fantasy, The Line, Witching Savannah, Book 1 by J.D. Horn. I got some help in making my choice on these. I ended up choosing The Line because the Goodreads group that we have for the Kindle Chronicles has a discussion topic called What Are You Selecting as Your Kindle First Title This Month? And this is a fun thread that's been quite active, and there was discussion of Soy Sauce for Beginners, which was the one that I read last time I really enjoyed. This time it seemed like most of the comments were aimed toward The Line, and as an example, Anne wrote, I picked The Line today too. Concept just sounded like fun, and the details seemed a bit different from standard urban fantasy. My friend Kes Woodward in Fairbanks wrote, I picked The Line too, mostly because of the link to Savannah. None of the options were books I would have picked otherwise, but What the Heck seems worth a look. I like the opportunity and hope it will occasionally lead me to a good book I wouldn't otherwise find. I'll also have a link to the 10 best contemporary war novels as chosen by Adrian Bonenberger for Publishers Weekly. And it's a good roundup of books. The top one on his list is The Brief and Frightening Reign of Phil by George Saunders. He's a really hot author these days. The Hunger Games was his number two pick by Suzanne Collins. The Kite Runner by Khaled Hosseini. And then there's others as well. So I'll have a link to that from Publishers Weekly, and you might find a book there that would be of interest to you. Last in content, I can always count on Jean Rample from Paris to provide me things I never would have thought of myself, and he's not letting me down, because the latest thing that he and Lila are doing is practicing Morse code, and I downloaded the app that he recommended. It's called AE Morse Code Tutor for $1.59, and it turned out, who knew, I had 159 Amazon coins, so I got it for free through that promotion. It gives you a way to actually type things in and hear what the Morse code would sound like, and apparently Jean and Lila are using it to communicate like at parties. They give each other's little taps when it's time to go, and if the grid goes down, which is something my parents are worried about with an EMP attack, the Morse code might turn out to be handy. That's it for this week. My guest next week will be a guy who is doing fabulous art books on the Kindle platform, hundreds of them. And I'm going to end with some Morse code from that app. If you can decode what this is saying and email it to me at podchronicles@gmail.com, the first person that sends an email with the right answer, I will come up with a suitable prize to honor your prowess with this ancient but still reliable form of communication. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles from Denver.